I think you also have to tell people these problems cannot be solved under capitalism. Right? It's not going to happen. And capitalism is going to ruin the world. And we're going to live under this, you know, these like white geoengineered skies with like a bunch of trillionaires controlling everything. Right. That's the future. So I think we need socialism. Socialism, it should be understood as this consciously controlled economy. Like, we decide what our interchange with nature will be. We decide, you know, how we should live and all that, rather than leaving it up to the market.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Dissens podcast. My guest is the environmental historian Troy Vitese. He studies the history of environmental economics, energy, and animal life under capitalism. Recently, he co-authored the book Half Earth Socialism, which takes a close look at the environmental crisis we are facing today and proposes a radical eco-socialist plan to save the future from extinction, climate change, and pandemics. Troy, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, Troy, saving the future from extinction, climate change, and pandemics. Kind of a bold statement.
Well, that subtitle was foisted on us by Verso. The book is a utopian book, right? And I forget the exact subtitle of Thomas More's Utopia, but it's like a small beneficial book for, you know, increasing the understanding of something or other. But I like this idea of like a small beneficial book, and I wanted to actually use that subtitle, but the marketing guys had the final say there.
So Troy, let's talk about life after capitalism and your book as well. One thing is clear, we're facing an increasingly dystopian future with climate disaster and mass extinction on the horizon. In your book, you propose eco-socialism as a solution. Let's start with our enemy here. Why do you think a sustainable life within capitalism is not achievable and we need to transition beyond capitalism?
So I wrote this book, Half of Socialism, with Drew, and that was kind of like a fun book on the side, right? I mean, it's also, it doesn't really belong to any obvious discipline. Like, there's a mix of like philosophy and ecology and history and all these other, there's even fiction in it and all that. My actual work as a historian is studying neoliberal environmental thought. So I wrote my dissertation on the emergence of cap and trade and then neoliberal debates with Malthusians in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And so I think I know the other side quite well, and I can see what they're up to in terms of how they want to solve the environmental crisis. And to me, it's actually quite disturbing that most ideas that are discussed for how to solve the crisis are neoliberal ideas, right? So we have cap and trade, for instance. We set like a limit to how much, I say, carbon is going to be emitted, and then the market will price the right to pollute. And that's what the European Union has with the ETS system. It hasn't worked very well. Mm-hmm. I mean, the average price, I think, for like the first 10 or 15 years of the program was like €3 a ton. So it's useless. And then the other thing they want to do is geoengineering. Right. In the long term, the idea is we'll get a bunch of scientists, entrepreneurs to then solve the crisis by cooling down the earth. Right. They'll put sulfur into the atmosphere that will reflect sunlight back into space, cooling things down. But it will cause many, many problems. It'll turn the sky white. You know, it would mess up precipitation patterns. It might mess up the monsoon. Like, many other things will go wrong. It's very dangerous, but it's very likely. And people are increasingly adopting this. Even socialists and environmentalists are embracing this technology more and more. Mm. And then the other idea that the neoliberals have is the commons, right? So Eleanor Ostrom, who lots of anarchists and lefties and degrowthers, you know, like, she's a neoliberal as well. And she wrote about the commons in her famous book in 1990 as like a small scale solution to various problems. So the fact that like all our main ideas for dealing with the environmental crisis come from neoliberals is probably a bad thing, because at some level, they're not interested in solving the environmental crisis. What the neoliberals really want to do is make sure they protect the market from government interference, right? What they really want to do is prevent the government from coming in and saying, like, we're going to shut down fossil fuel, you know, infrastructure. We're going to, you know, prohibit certain activities or ban SUVs or whatever, because that will mess up the market mechanism. And neoliberals are unusual as far as economists go, because they see the market not merely as a site of exchange, but really as this omniscient being in some ways. Like, they see the market in theological terms, right? And therefore, they have to protect the market. Mm. So that's basically the one side. And the book begins, like our book, Half of Socialism, begins with us discussing what's probably going to happen in the next 25 years. And even if mainstream environmentalists succeed in imposing various kinds of like cap and trade programs or increasing energy efficiency and all that, it won't be enough to actually cause absolute reductions in terms of how much carbon we're emitting or how much land we're using for agriculture and all that. And therefore, the environmental crisis will get worse and we'll have climate change, we'll have mass extinction, we'll have zoonoses and all that. Mm. And I just don't think capitalism can deal with the environmental crisis. And I got into Marxism by way of the environmental question because I wanted to understand why is this there this need for growth. And I think a lot of degrowthers, a lot of ecological economists, they describe economic growth as merely a cultural phenomenon, right? Like people like growth. And then we just have to give up on growth. And the Marxist approach is that economic growth is part of the system and capitalists are competing with each other in terms of increasing productivity or finding new markets. And this is going to increase the amount of the world in terms of its commodification, right? Increase the amount of nature that's going to be subsumed. And if that doesn't happen, then there's going to be an economic crisis. So capitalism can't stop, right? It can't be restrained. And if it is restrained, then capitalists are going to find ways around it. So I just don't think capitalism can deal with it. And therefore, the question is, we need socialism. Socialism, it should be understood as this consciously controlled economy. Like we decide what our interchange with nature will be. We decide how we should live and all that, rather than leaving that up to the market, right? But if we give up on markets, then we have to find other ways of planning the economy. So that's basically what the book is trying to do, is to figure out this problem.
Troy, you already talked a bit about why green capitalism is a myth. Maybe you can elaborate a bit more on that, because I think we still have to rebut this hegemonic project that is forming there right now, that is saying basically you don't have to change the way you're living, the amount of energy, for example, that you consume as a person living in the global north. We don't have to change production. We don't have to change consumption, change social relations. We just have to go in the direction of electric cars, for example, or retrofit houses, expand renewable energies and stuff like that. But you in your book specifically say that all these things are not enough, and as well as market mechanisms are not enough. So maybe you can elaborate a bit more about these shortcomings of this mainstream environmentalism that we also see in the green parties that are in power in Europe, for example, for instance, here in Germany.
So the problem with environmental movements is that they come from a philosophical position based on Malthusianism, generally. And this was especially clear in the 1960s and 70s when they said, well, the big problem is too many people, overpopulation is population bomb and all this kind of stuff. And therefore, we have to reduce population if we want to have a better environment. And what's interesting is like back then, they, because of that perspective, they were willing to countenance pretty severe government interventions into the market to deal with scarce resources and to try to create a steady state economy of some sort. And this is where neoliberals are really pushing against these like Malthusian environmentalists, such as Gerhard Hardin or Ehrlich, for example. And then by the 1980s and 90s, that part of the environmental movement was broken in lots of ways. It seemed like they had lost that debate and the environmental movement became much weaker. And then they were co-opted by a lot of neoliberal ideas of seeking win-win solutions and should not be as antagonistic towards conservatives and towards business and adopt things like cap and trade. But I think environmentalists now, they're like a weird mix where they're still a bit Malthusian and they're a bit neoliberal, but they're not socialists. Like, there are very few environmentalists who really deal seriously with socialism or with Marxism. And that's really unfortunate, because I think if you don't see the ultimate cause of the problem being capitalism, then you're not going to find a proper solution to it, right? You're going to think you can have these win-win solutions, or you're going to keep blaming poor people in the global south for the environmental problems that we face. Mm-hmm. In terms of green capitalism in general, I would say you have to be a real fool at this point to still believe that this program is working, right? I mean, people have been talking about this for 40 years, and it hasn't delivered anything. Right. I mean, like the amount of carbon being emitted is still going up. The extinction rate is still going up. It's simply not working. So we have to think, how can we achieve these absolute reductions? And I think maybe why the green capitalist discourse is still appealing is because it's not clear exactly what kind of standard of living works for an ecologically stable society, right? Like, how much can we actually consume, right? Wait, is an electric car enough? You know, should I not be flying? You know, should I be eating meat or just organic or whatever is kind of thing? Because we are only see the market from our own perspective as consumers, and we don't see the totality, right? We don't see what collective consumption is really like and how it relates to each other. Then we have these like dumb debates at some level, right? Mm-hmm. And I think what we're trying to do in the book is, you know, we draw a lot on this Viennese philosopher named Otto Neurath. And Neurath, he was saying that socialism is this conscious control of society, is conscious control of the economy and society regulating itself. And to do that, society has to be able to see itself and see the economy. So he set up these museum exhibitions where he would try to show the economy to the working class of Vienna through graphic design and data visualization. So if you can imagine seeing the economy, then you can have debates about what we do with the economy. And this leads to his definition of economic democracy, which is us making a bunch of total plans. Like, what do we do with all the resources we have and so forth? What kind of lives do we want to live? Like, how many hospitals do we build? How many schools do we build or whatever? And then we compare these total plans and vote on them. Mm. So we adopt this in the book as well. And we're saying, okay, to, you know, the green capitalists or to, you know, anyone else, what is your total plan, right? Like, you have people who are, you know, very rich in the global north and a bunch of poor people in the global south. And what's your carbon budget? You know, how much extinction are you willing to have? How are you going to power all this? And then you can start having real debates. We can see that electric cars are not going to solve the problem, right? You can see that organic meat's not going to solve the problem. But we like to do that when we have these total plans.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the topic of planning a bit later. Let's talk a bit about your book and your idea of half-Earth socialism in general. A lot of debate now focuses on eco-socialism. Is that also something that the publisher pushed you towards, to name it half-Earth socialism, or why not eco-socialism but half-Earth socialism?
So what we were trying to do with the name of half-Earth socialism was that we wanted to basically signal a few things. One would be that the climate crisis is not the only environmental crisis that's happening, as in the biodiversity crisis, you know, the extinction crisis is massive, is as important or even more important than the climate crisis. Hmm. But we're not talking about it, right? So, and the half-Earth is an idea to actually conserve, you know, half the world into the nature preserves of some sort to prevent mass extinction from happening. So we want to really center that. I think it also centers the importance of land as an issue, right? This idea of, like, we don't have enough land to achieve all the goals, such as, you know, growing food or energy production or conservation and all that. So land becomes a central category, and it really is a central category of the book. And I think the half-Earth is also a sign of the kind of socialism we're espousing, which is really a humble kind of socialism, as in, like, you know, we can solve the environmental crisis, we can ensure everyone has a good life, but we do have to give something up. Right, we can't have everything. There's going to be trade-offs somewhere, right? So this is very different from, like, fully automated luxury communism where everyone gets everything kind of thing. So we only can get half, right? And then we'll figure out the rest. So that's what we wanted to do with this half-Earth. I mean, we definitely are eco-socialists, and we're, you know, I'm close friends with Andreas Malm, you know, for instance, and we're part of that debate. But we also don't agree with, you know, other eco-socialists on everything. We think we're doing something also a bit different from other eco-socialists, right? So we're critical of Marx in a way that, say, John Bellamy Foster or Seito Kohi aren't, right? We're the same, well, Marx is actually this really ecological thinker and all that. I think you really have to address the Promethean strand within Marxism head on. Mm-hmm. And I think they really exaggerate the ecological side of Marx.
What you mean by Promethean, like a productivist leftist strand or...?
Yes, this idea that we can dominate nature, and actually it's good to dominate nature because then we can have this abundance, and socialism will actually increase the domination of nature, right? And this idea that we'll move mountains, we'll, like, redirect rivers, we'll control the atmosphere. Like, the idea of geoengineering actually comes from a Soviet scientist, which is quite revealing, you know? Yeah. And then we want it to be more definite in terms of what kind of society, you know, we want and how it would function as in what were the planning mechanisms and all that. And that's a bit different from, you know, again, I like Andreas's work quite a lot, but I think there's not enough about, like, what's going to come after capitalism, right? So we want to do that with the book. So that's how we kind of fit into this broader debate.
Yeah, let us talk a bit more about half-Earth socialism, how it would look like. You kind of put forward three simple solutions toward the ecological and climate crisis, which are like pillars of what you think could be a half-Earth socialism. The first one you already hinted upon is planetary rewildering, so giving back space to nature. And the second one is widespread vegan diet for humanity, complete vegan diet or predominantly vegan diet. And the third one is renewable energies and energy quotas. So let's start with planetary rewildering, where the name of your eco-socialism, half-Earth socialism, comes from. Just recently, I think the question of global ecocide and biodiversity was put into forefront a little bit more and into mainstream discourse. But still, even within the climate movement, and more so on the left even, the problem of habitat loss and mass extinction is often overlooked. So why do you think it's so important for us humans to reserve more space for wildlife? So why do you focus so much on this idea of half-Earth, half of the Earth for the environment and half of the Earth for humanity?
Well, extinction is tragic, I think, for the animals themselves. And I think we have to ask, you know, what gives us the right to cause so much destruction, to be such a brutal force in the world? I mean, we are on track to cause 50% of species to disappear, you know, within a century or so. That's the same as what happened, you know, 66 million years ago when an asteroid hit the Earth and wiped out the dinosaurs and all that. So the fact that we are as destructive as like a gigantic asteroid should be a problem, right? We should, I think this is a moral problem at some point, right? We have to say, why is that okay? I mean, are we better than animals? Should we not care about animals? And I think there's really an ethical aspect. We don't get into that into the book so much, because I think at some level, a lot of people don't care about animal rights. And I think that's a real problem. And we are appealing to people who may not even care about animal rights and say, well, even if you don't think animals are worthy of consideration, you should still care about the environmental crisis and the biodiversity crisis, because it will affect you regardless, right? And one of these ways it will affect us is by destabilizing the biosphere, we're going to get a lot more zoonotic diseases emerging. So whenever there's some kind of instability, there's a chance that a pathogen will find a new host and it will evolve in various unpleasant ways and will cause an epidemic. Right? And this can be anything. It could be, you know, animal testing has been the cause of the Marburg virus, which, you know, occurred in Germany, for instance. You have like suburbs in the Northeast United States causing Lyme disease because of habitat fragmentation and biodiversity loss amongst forests there. You know, like the exotic pet trade, but also, of course, animal husbandry is a huge cause of zoonotic diseases. And that's because it causes deforestation. So animals are going to be changing how they live. For example, in Australia, because of deforestation happening there, bat populations are fragmented. So you don't have a single pool of disease, but rather several different pools of disease. So when the bats actually come in contact with each other, then they will have their own outbreaks. And then the other thing is that bats would be coming into cities much more because they don't have the same wild habitat that they used to. And therefore, they're closer to people and closer to livestock. And then we get emergence of diseases like Hendra or Nipah virus, which are extremely nasty viruses. And people are just waiting for something like avian flu to spread, which will have a mortality rate of 50%. So this is really bad, of course. And of course, we rely on the natural world for many things, such as, you know, pollinating crops and so forth. But I think it's a mix of being practical and being empathetic towards other animals. And this is also related to the problem of carbon sequestration. So if you have a huge amount of land that's rewilded, then you're going to sequester a lot more carbon. So you should think about the carbon cycle as really a relationship between the biosphere and the lithosphere.
What does sequester, sorry for my non-native speakers, sequester, does that mean to store the carbon, like bind it and...
Yes, yeah.
So that it doesn't get into the atmosphere.
Yes. So as in, we want to take atmospheric carbon and also more carbon from the oceans, because the oceans have too much carbon in them, and then restore it either mostly in soils or in vegetation, and then that way we can actually moderate climate change and bring down the amount of carbon in the atmosphere from like over 400 parts per million down to like the low 300s, right? Which at that point is pretty close to the pre-industrial level. And that's possible, but it's going to take a huge amount of land to do that. And a wilder area stores more carbon than, let's say, a tree plantation or something like that. So, and that's because you have all these relationships between a predator and prey species, and that will increase the resilience of an ecosystem. Like, for example, when the population of sea otters returned off the west coast of North America, they were eating sea urchins. And so that meant that the kelp could come back, and kelp can store a huge amount of carbon, right? But you needed that relationship between the otters and the kelp and the sea urchins. And we see this in other ecosystems, let's say wolves and all that in Yellowstone Park. So my point is we should be caring about biodiversity for practical reasons and for ethical reasons. And it's just like the easiest way to sequester carbon at a huge scale. Like if you want to sequester 800 gigatons of carbon, there's no other way to do it except through rewilding. Other technologies such as carbon capture and storage or direct air capture, they're extremely expensive. They're extremely hard to scale up. They're energy intensive, and they can't be deployed in the way that rewilding can.
Yeah, in the book, you also call rewilding kind of a natural geoengineering.
Yes, yes.
So maybe you can clear up for me how much of the global land area is protected wilderness right now, because I don't know that. And maybe a lot of people out there ask themselves, okay, so how much more would we have to need to give to nature? And what would this process of rewilding actually look like?
So now about 15%.
Only 15, okay.
Yeah, so it has to go up, you know, three times or so. And probably of that 15% is probably like lots of nature reserves are actually not very well maintained. I mean, for example, when I was in Berlin recently, we went to a nature preserve to go bird watching, and there was quite, you know, large scale farming happening in the supposed preserve.
Yeah.
Right. So I would not call that a nature preserve if you have like tractors and tons of cows and all that. But so it probably is, you know, E.O. Wilson says probably it's more like 10% rather than the 15%. So we have to increase the amount of protected area by 3 to 5 times. And then the amount of ocean that's preserved is minuscule. I think it's around 2% or something like that. But we also have to care about the ocean. I was talking about the sea otters. The ocean could also sequester a huge amount of carbon. And we know very little actually about what people call blue carbon, like how much carbon the ocean could preserve. But, you know, whales or fish populations need to rebound because they are also part of the carbon cycle. And if they recover, then we'll actually be sequestering a lot more carbon that way as well.
So you take the idea of half Earth from the biologist Edward Wilson, who proposed to rewild half of the planet to end the loss of biodiversity. Why actually half Earth? Why not a third or maybe even 75%, right, to end the loss of biodiversity and have all these positive side effects on climate as well? So why exactly half of the Earth? How does that number come about?
So there's a relationship that Wilson discovered with a collaborator in the 1960s. They were studying island biogeography, and that meant that the larger an island was, it tended to have more biodiversity. So basically, nature preserves now are islands on the land, right? As in they're islands of biodiversity surrounded by civilization of different kinds, right? And they're fragmented, and they act the same way as these Caribbean islands that they studied in the 1960s. And the relationship is if you reduce the land area, then you'll see the reduction of biodiversity according to the fourth root, right? So that means that if you lose 90% of, let's say, a habitat, then you'll lose half the species, right? And we're on track for that. So again, I was saying 10%, 10-50% is well preserved. If all the biodiversity is really in those nature preserves and nowhere else, then we'll lose half of all species. And that's pretty much what's going to happen, right? Mm-hmm. And if we preserve half the world, then we actually will reverse that. So we would actually preserve around 85% of all species. That means we would lose, 10 or 15% of species, which is still bad, of course, right? Still tragic, but it's not on the scale of a mega extinction event. you know, we're living through the sixth extinction, right? This has only happened, you know, five previous times since life began, which is obviously a long time ago, so which tells you how serious the crisis is. But a loss of 10% at some level will not threaten the system itself, right? But you know, but of course, I'm willing to entertain debates about this and be like, well, actually, maybe we should try to preserve 70% of land and then try to reduce that extinction rate even further.
I mean, it's going to be hard to cling each and every percentage from capitalist globalization. So,
well, I mean, half Earth can't be achieved within capitalism. It's not going to happen, right? Yeah.
But we can talk about transition and stuff like that.
Sure. But I'll say one more thing, that in the book, you know, my co-author, he made a linear program. And that basically says you can put in how you're going to make your energy. You know, are you going to electrify the transport sector? You know, what is your energy quota? How much land do you want to preserve? What's your carbon budget and all that? And then it will shoot out an answer. It will tell you whether your plan is possible or not, right? Based on these basic constraints. And I think in the book, we actually talk about increasing the amount of protected areas to 70% and all that. And again, we should be having these kind of debates about how much do we want to protect? What are we okay with in terms of extinction? But that's where the measure comes from, or the concept comes from.
Yeah, just recently I read that right now it's going on, but when this interview is published in January, it's probably going to be over, the United Nations Conference on Biodiversity. And their delegates of almost all of the states came together to strike a new treaty to end biodiversity loss. There seems to be this commitment to have 30% of the planet's surface reserved for nature, which is something that could be part of an international treaty agreement. So how do you think about this aim, 30%? And how do you think in general about this Convention on Biological Diversity, these states coming together, delegates, and striking up these plans and ideas? But we kind of see with the Paris Agreement, you can have ideas, but if like there's the underlying issue of you have an economy that needs to grow capitalism, then we're not going to achieve these aims.
I forget the exact numbers, but when they met, you know, like 10 years ago and they set goals for 2020, like they didn't meet the goals, right? So I mean, like whatever's going to happen in 2030, I don't think they're going to meet it. But yeah, it's not to say that these diplomats are fools, right? They know that they're achieving something or trying to achieve something that's very difficult, especially within a capitalist system, of course. But I think the idea of having this like 30% by 2030, this like 30 by 30 is kind of a bit of PR, right? And the end goal for, I mean, a lot of people who are pushing this include E.O. Wilson's foundation, right? The Half Earth group. And there's also a group called the Wild Foundation. They were the first really to come up with this idea that Wilson later adopted. And they have something called Nature Needs Half, right? And they're also pushing the 30 by 30. And that's kind of like a halfway step to their ultimate goal of 50%, right? So I think it's good that they're trying, but I think the more you'll be trying to do this, the more you'll see there's going to be a squeeze, right? In terms of competing for other goals, as in we're going to have a squeeze in terms of like meat production, right? They're going to be conflicting there. For example, I think California wants to have a 30 by 30, but it's already something like 60% of all land in California is used as rangeland for the meat industry, right? So it's going to be hard to get that 30% space and have space for everything else, especially renewable energy infrastructure, because they take up, you know, solar power and wind power, they're great, we need them, but they're not as efficient in terms of how much space they need as fossil fuels are, right? Fossil fuels are more power dense, as in the amount of energy produced per square meter is many times higher. So if we want to have a fully renewable energy system, then we're going to need a lot more space for that system. And that's going to compete with conservation and with food production. And we're seeing these conflicts happening already. I mean, people are trying to put like wind farms or solar panels in nature preserves. And then people are saying, well, why are these environmentalists complaining about, you know, the energy industry? Don't they like that? But it's going to, you know, kill off this endangered tortoise or whatever, right? Like we're already having these conflicts and it's going to get much worse as time goes on.
What I found also interesting and where we need to be wary is that the idea of Half Earth, you mentioned the Wild Foundation that pushes for that idea. That also has links to conservative and at times racist politics. And we see also with these nature preservations that there are at times indigenous rights, for example, are trampled. So human rights are trampled So how real is the threat of expanding nature preserves is burdening poor and indigenous people? And how do we as socialists deal with this colonial past of this idea and maybe neo-colonial forms of half-earthism?
So I think a lot of lefties, they see this racist heritage, its colonial heritage of the conservation movement, and then they kind of, you know, dust their hands and be like, well, that's bad, and we don't want to do that. And they leave it there, right? And they don't articulate what does a socialist approach look like. And the book is trying to say, these conservationists, E.O. Wilson himself was a very flawed figure, and he's at some level fairly harmless compared to some of these other people who are, again, working with like apartheid South Africa and all that, or working with like Rhodesian mercenaries. Like, these are really unsavory people who are racist, anti-socialists, and all that. But at some level, we have to recognize that the biogeography that Wilson studied is correct, right? There is this relationship between land area and biodiversity. So therefore, we have to say, as socialists, you know, we want to stop this mass extinction event from happening. What is our solution? And it has to be different from what's proposed by these conservationists. I mean, they basically are relying on philanthropists to buy up large areas and then turn those areas into exotic ranches where you sell like bison meat, or, you know, in Europe, they have the aurochs again, which is like the original cow, like the wild cow. And that's you can sell that for a premium as exotic meat, or you have like, ecotourism, right? That's the other revenue, or you have a game, as in, you have hunting happening for rich people. That's not a great model, right? That's not going to exist under socialism. So we have to think seriously of integrating conservation efforts with the whole package and say, you know, how are we going to help people, increase their living standards to do other things and not be just simply pushed off their land. But I think this is also where we have to think more critically about, let's say, some small-scale farming now, right? I think people feel uncomfortable saying to a relatively poor farmer in the global south, like, you have to change at some level, right? And they want to romanticize the figure of the peasant. But I think we have to, we have to be careful, and we have to think further about this. I think quite a bit about Poyang Lake, which is the largest lake in China, and half of it is a nature preserve, and the other half is full of poultry farming. And this isn't industrial scale poultry farming, but it's not subsistence poultry farming either, right? So instead of like having like 10 ducks, that people now have like 100 ducks, which is, again, small scale, but still much more. And it's extremely dangerous because you have all these birds migrating through and they're meeting all these farmed ducks. So like probably you'll have an avian flu breakout there if it breaks out anywhere. Right. And what should we do about this? Right. Well, we should make sure that people have high living standards and have good education and good healthcare and so forth. But I think we do have to push a bit and think about what needs to be changed overall. And this should not be done in an authoritarian manner, but hopefully should be done in a democratic, planned way. But we need to be having these debates instead of these really romantic pictures of agroecology or, you know, the figure of the peasant and so forth. But it's definitely, it has to be different from the conservation model we have now.
Yeah, but one thing I learned in your book, and I can recommend it really to everybody out there, it's of course in English. Is there going to be a German translation, by the way?
Sadly, no. We haven't been contacted about that. There is a Spanish translation that's going to come out soon and a Korean translation, but that's about it so far. So hopefully the German publisher is hearing this. Talk to me.
Yeah, call Troy, call me. We exchange contacts, publish this in German. It's a great book. And I think the German climate justice movement needs to read that, and environmentalists need to read it in order to bridge differences and to push for something like a eco-socialism. So let's talk a bit about the way we are eating. So I hinge upon that one other pillar is veganism, widespread veganism, or at least like a predominantly vegan diet. And you already talked about how the way we are eating and the way we are producing food, and especially the industrial scale animal farming and our overconsumption of meat, is driving habitat loss. And this, again, is the biggest driver of extinction of species. So maybe you can explain a bit more how animal husbandry is the leading cause of biodiversity loss.
So I think when people have debates about land use, they're often thinking about suburbs. So we have these like endless dumb debates saying, well, actually everyone should live like in New York City and suburbs are bad and just like pack them everyone in. There's this one architect and he had this super dystopian vision of the future that was accidentally dystopian. I think he thought it was a great idea where you're going to pack like 10 billion people into one mega city.
Like in the line that they are producing right now somewhere in the Emirates, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then the rest of the world will be wilderness, right? And just like 10 billion people living in one space, you know? And the thing is, you know, cities and suburbs and all that, they take up, you know, I think suburbs are a problem, of course. And, you know, people shouldn't be having this urban sprawl. But it takes up only like 1 or 2% of the Earth's surface. Mm. Inhabitable surface, which excludes like glaciers and mountains and things like that. So that's about 10 billion hectares is the amount of land we have to play with in terms of inhabitable land. And around 4 billion hectares, so 40% is used for livestock. And nothing else comes close to that.
40%.
40% of the inhabitable world, yes. And if the meat industry keeps on growing, which is supposed to double in the next few decades, right? Where it's crazy. Like, how are we going to feed all these animals? You're going to use up the whole world, basically, be growing crops or having pasture for these animals. Mm-hmm. And you have to think about it as well as if you're a vegan, you only need a tenth of a hectare of land to live. That will make you enough food, right? And if you're a vegetarian, you need 0.4 hectares of land. But if you're an omnivore, you need more than a hectare. So if we really want to save land, the easiest way is for us to give up meat because that saves 90% of the land.
So how much land would be then taken up by agriculture globally when it's now like 40% only for animal farming?
Yeah, so like 1 billion hectares is used for crops for people, right? So that in total is 5 billion hectares are used for agriculture. And what's used for the calories that we get from all this livestock production is around 20%, right? A bit less than 20% of our calories. So you can imagine that if we got rid of animal agriculture, then we would need like 1.2 billion hectares. And that means that we would have like 3.5 billion hectares to play around with for rewilding and for renewable energy infrastructure. And that just relieves all these pressures we have on land. I was saying before, there's all these trade-offs. If you get rid of the meat industry, not only do you get rid of the threat of zoonoses, like new diseases, and you also get rid of the huge amount of greenhouse gas emissions you have from animal agriculture. Animal agriculture produces more greenhouse gas emissions than transportation, but we don't talk about that nearly as much. And then suddenly you have all these carbon sinks and you have higher biodiversity and all these other advantages. And also, even epidemiologists say that we need to have more nature preserves to act as like a buffer between us and other animals, right? So we have all these benefits. And the only thing we have to pay for is you can't eat a steak anymore, right? Mm. And to me, it seems like a no-brainer. Like, I think you can't say at the same time that the environmental crisis is like the worst thing in the world. It's such a serious issue. It's a civilizational problem. And then say, well, we can't ask people to make any sacrifices at all. I mean, like, you can't say both those things. And the point with the book is that, you know, you have these total plans and you say like, oh, you know, what trade-offs are you willing to make? Like, do you want to have a stable climate and not have diseases, or do you want to have like a hamburger, right? And again, for other issues that we need to deal with in terms of dealing with climate change, let's say like changing how we produce steel or, you know, changing how we make cement and many other things that are very hard to decarbonize, changing the agricultural sector is extremely easy. I mean, that can be done within a year or a few years, right? Versus like making new subway lines or getting rid of cars and all that, or the energy infrastructure needs to replace. Because right now, only 2% of all energy is produced by wind and solar.
But when it comes to the diet, I think you have like kind of the biggest opposition. At least here in Germany, it's when somebody is putting forward to actually only reduce the amount of livestock. You have a huge outcry. Like more so even than when people say, okay, we need to change from cars to public transport and to bikes and stuff like that, you know? So there's something that is so unique about this question of diet and so personal. So, and it's also connected to toxic masculinity, for example.
Of course.
So I want to eat my steak. Yeah. So it's going to be a struggle for sure.
But of course, it's going to be a struggle, right? But I think we need to be having these conversations, and we're not having these conversations, right? And, you know, it's funny where, Drew and I, we wrote this book. It's about creating this vegan socialist world and all that. And people are obsessed with this meat problem. And to me, the meat thing, you know, people talk about it the most. And to me, it's much harder to plan the world economy without markets or money. That's going to be much harder, right? That's a real problem. Eating tofu is not a problem.
But did you turn vegan by studying all these things about the capitalist animal farming industry, or were you vegan before that?
I was vegetarian. I turned vegetarian late because I also had my own toxic masculinity. I was a bit of a bro and working out a lot and all that, eating lots of meat. And then I began to reflect on that. I became vegetarian. I have a bunch of vegetarian friends, and I became vegetarian. And that's because there really aren't good arguments to eat meat, right? I mean, you have to say like we're better than animals, or I don't care. I can do whatever I want to animals. And I think like you can't have a coherent position, really. And then you realize as a vegetarian that you're still implicated in a system that is killing animals. So if you're drinking milk, that milk comes from cows that are constantly pregnant so that they lactate. Then they take the calves away, they take the baby cows and turn them into veal. So like the veal milk industry are connected, right? Or if you're eating eggs, all the male chickens are like ground up, you know, and they in a blender. So, I mean, like you're still connected. So that's why I became, it was more for like the ethical reasons, but I think the environmental reasons are just as strong, of course.
Yeah, myself, I'm not a vegan, not even a vegetarian. I eat now and then, I eat meat. That's going to lead probably to some terminations of subscriptions right now here. But we need to have these discussions. We need to talk about our personal diets also on a global level, the exporting farming industry. And for sure, we need to massively, massively reduce the amount of meat that's produced, the amount of livestock, that's for sure. I had persons on the podcast here when it comes to agriculture that argued for some limited, really, really limited organic animal farming, which they deemed to be necessary for agriculture and also sustainable. But that is a topic for a whole nother podcast.
Well, I can touch on that briefly. I mean, like...
All right. I'll give you the last word on this, and then we go on to the renewables and energy quotas topic. But go on.
Sure. I mean, I would just say briefly, because this is, like, I think a real debate. Like, I was in Spain recently, and Alberto Garzón, who's the Minister of Consumer Affairs, he's pissed off a lot of people because he's saying to everyone, you should eat less meat. Again, not even you should be vegan, you should eat less meat. Mm-hmm. And this is already pissing people off.
Yeah.
And then I was talking to activists there as well, and they were telling me that there's a huge divide in the environmental movement between people who are vegetarian or vegan, and then there's some people like, oh, if we have like a little pastoral, you know, scene with like some goats, and you know, it's not factory farming but old school farming, surely that's all right, you know. And I would say it's like, I think people don't really realize how little meat consumption is actually sustainable. Right. If you're only consuming, let's say, like 5 kilograms of meat a year, that means you're eating like a little bit of chicken soup once a week. Right. Like it's so close already to veganism or vegetarianism. Like it's kind of almost pointless. And it's like, well, why not just go all the way at that point? And again, with these total.
Yeah, but it also might be that we could have like for the Easter meal or for like the Christmas meal, for example, or for some kind of other religious holiday, people could have. Like this small amount of meat that's possible under the restrictions that we have to deal with.
But I would also say that the animal, you know, liberation movement is a fairly isolated movement. It tends to be very utilitarian. You know, I don't agree with all their politics and all that, but they're very dedicated and they engage in sabotage all the time. And I think they would be great allies to have. Right. But instead we have like, you know, a climate movement, we have an animal rights movement, we have a socialist movement, and they're all fairly divided from each other. But if brought together, I think they could do a lot more.
Yeah. Okay, Troy, let's talk a bit about the last pillar of you have of socialism is like 100% renewables. And that also tackles like those people that are putting forward nuclear power as a solution to climate crisis in Germany, not so much because the anti-nuclear movement here is fairly large, but still, of course, there are some people who are putting that forward and even in the environmental camp. And also energy quotas, this might be more controversial. So how much less energy would people like me in the global north or people like you have to consume in order to live globally just? And what would that actually mean for our lifestyle?
It's funny where I went on this one interview with a really hostile, meat eating socialist, and he conceded, he's like, okay, I'm happy with energy quotas, but don't take away my meat. And I think it's, and again, to me, it's like the energy quota thing is going to be tough, right? So we take the framework from ETH Zurich, and some people there 20 years ago, they were saying, well, if everyone had 2000 watts available to them, mm-hmm. which was the global average back then there'd be a fair world, and you know, you won't have like, big differences between global north and global south, and it's sustainable and so forth. And that means shrinking consumption at, say, like in settler colonial countries like the US, Canada, Australia, where they, you know, these big countries with lots of space and lots of waste, they use around 12,000 watts a person,
yeah.
right, on average. The top 1%, I mean, they're like way higher than even that, right? But I mean, on average, 12,000 watts.
But it's not only the 1%. Sometimes you have like lefties who are overly obsessed with the class distinctions within like the global north, and they like say, just cap the 1%, their consumption, and we're going to be good. But no. Like globally, people in the global north, like in the middle class, they have to also massively reduce. Like I did this test of the 2,000 watt society, which is like close to my hometown now. I live in Konstanz at the Lake Konstanz, and it's in Zurich, right? In Switzerland. So, and you're not able to meet that goal, even if you live like a really scarce life, because you rely on all these public transportation and stuff like that. So it's like a massive effort that needs to be done in order that everybody can live that way.
You know, you're definitely right. The saying just the 1% or just the big corporations are the problem. You're right. Everyone has to change, right? And I'm saying even down to, let's say, like poor farmers in the global south, it's, you know, talk about what do they have to do as well, right? I mean, everyone has to change. It's a big problem that we're facing. But it's still like, you know, right? And on average, 12,000 watts, which, you know, this average person is way far from 2,000 watts. In Western Europe, it's like 5,000 or 6,000 watts is the average.
Yeah.
And again, after two, yeah, as you're saying, it's quite difficult. And I think and you're talking about this test, it shows you the limits of like a politics of individual consumption, right? Because you have to change infrastructure. People to use less energy, we have to make our cities different so people are more efficient in various ways. You need passive homes, or you need cogeneration. You need public infrastructure, public transportation, and all that, and so that people can actually live a fairly modest lifestyle. And I think it's important to say this is not going to be so brutal. Like, we're not going to be living in caves or something like that. There's some of these eco-hipstery neighborhoods, like in Freiburg, it's called like Vauban. Or, you know, there's a few of these neighborhoods where they've built passive homes, and people don't have cars there, and all this. And then people, or at least they rent cars, and when they need them. And I think something like living like a hipster in Freiburg, I mean, you don't eat meat, and you don't fly, you take a train and all that. That should be the goal. Right, it shouldn't be like an all the way like a anarcho-primitivist endpoint. Like we want to have like decent lives for everyone, but it's still going to be serious cuts, as you're saying, and that also includes meat consumption, right? And meat consumption is also part of that energy quota. But once we actually have these energy quotas, I mean, they're important because they make it easier to make the energy system fully renewable. Like if you actually only have to make, like a quarter of the system renewable rather than trying to replace everything, right? Then you're going to get to that goal faster. And you're also going to take up less land. So, and the biggest land user would be, biofuels. But again, even wind and solar use up a lot of energy. So if you have like Germany or the UK, if they were fully renewable, according to some estimates, say from I use from Black Hills Meal, the whole country would have to be covered like in biofuel plantations or wind farms and all that. But if you reduce that energy quota to 2,000 watts, then even if you have some inefficiencies such as these biofuel plantations, you still would only have like a third of the land being used for renewable energy. So even a country like Germany could have like a half earth scenario where half the country is rewilded and all that. So I think we have to play around with these problems. And then we have to talk about the internationalist aspect, right? We can't say, us in the global north, we're going to stay rich and have like really use up a lot of energy, and the global south has to stay poor. I mean, that's not fair. Mm. And then the nuclear question is related to this, because we're talking about these total plans, right? And I think environmentalists, mainstream environmentalists, who a lot of them have become pro-nuclear, they're making the wager that, okay, we want to decarbonize, but we can't ask people to make any sacrifices whatsoever because their politics are pathetic. And therefore, some kind of decarbonization, we need to, but with high energy production, we have to rely on nuclear. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like Schellenberger or even like James Hansen, or I think Monbiot goes back and forth on this. I can't remember where he is now, but they all support nuclear. The thing is, if you actually have that many nuclear reactors, if you actually increase the number of nuclear reactors tenfold, right, then you're going to quickly run out of uranium that's easy to mine. And then your carbon intensity of the uranium mining is going to go up so much that nuclear is no longer a carbon neutral source of energy, right? And then they have to rely on, you know, they know this, like they're not idiots. So they then say, well, we'll rely on other forms of nuclear power, like fast breeder reactors. And this is a technology that simply doesn't work. Right? I mean, these fast breeders, which produce plutonium as a byproduct, they're attractive to nations because they want to have basically plutonium factories for their H-bombs, right? But they're not good at producing energy because if there's any leak at all, the coolant is made of liquid sodium, so it catches fire. And you don't want to have your nuclear reactor on fire, right? So they're always down for repairs, and they actually produce very little energy. So it's a total mess. Like, I don't understand I think the nuclear bros are similar to the guys who don't want to eat meat all the time, because it's kind of like this weird macho energy source at some level. But it's not going to work. And I think the nuclear question is like the most popular thing the environmentalist movement has ever come up with, right? That's the only thing that wins the majorities, like in referendums, like nothing else does, right? So to actually say we're going to be a pro-nuclear is the best way to demobilize the environmental movement.
Yeah, and when we look at the war in the Ukraine, Russia's war against Ukraine, and we see what happens with the nuclear power plant there, or what could happen, and what happened with power plants in the past, plastering the world like with the hundreds of nuclear power plants seems like a dumb, really dumb idea in volatile times.
It's insane. Yeah.
So that leaves us obviously with energy quotas and with sacrificing some of our consumption in the global north because renewables, some people think that renewables are kind of limitless and endless in supply, but they're actually not. There's this problem of storage, for example, when you have like, it's called Dunkelflaute in Deutsch, when you have like the skies are gray in winter and the sun is not shining or the wind is not blowing, right? So that's one part of it, which I don't think can correlate with a growing capitalism. That's the one side. And the other side is the land use, the land mass that you focus in your book about.
Yeah, it's going to be extremely hard to have a 100% renewable energy system, right? I mean, it causes lots of instability, and you're saying there's problems with storage. And you know, one way to deal with those problems is to actually have redundant capacity, which means you need more, this infrastructure, right? But to aim for like less production, but that just makes the problem worse, right? If you want to have like 12,000 watts per person, then you need a huge amount of renewable energy infrastructure. And again, as I was saying, we're only at 2% of global energy production, so it's going to take us a long time to get to 100%. And there's some things that are extremely hard to decarbonize, as I was saying, like cement and steel and aviation fuel are pretty much impossible to decarbonize. They're very hard to decarbonize, and we'll have to figure that out as well. So I think this idea of like, oh, renewables will solve anything is simply incorrect. And of course, you know, when we have to have all these electric cars, that's going to make the problem harder as well, right? So if we actually just had more efficient kinds of public transportation with, you know, trams and subways and all that, then it would make the transition easier to accomplish. Because again, we don't have much time as well to build all this out.
Yeah, this brings us to the topic of planning. That's also a big part in your book, because one thing is for sure, like rewildering half of the earth, dismantling the meat production, and like strict energy quotas that would reduce the mass of our consumption, that can't be actually achieved within capitalism. That can only be achieved when we transition to a post-capitalist society. So how would we actually organize such a production and consumption without markets?
So again, it got to the hardest part of the book.
And the most controversial, even within lefties.
Yeah. And I think we are just sketching out in the book. We're trying to be more concrete than most books. I think a lot of lefty books, they just kind of do a hand wave saying, well, we'll have socialism and it'll be awesome. Like, just trust me, you know? And we think, you know, again, we are utopian socialists as well as being Marxists. And we say, we need to think seriously about what is the utopia that we're fighting for? How is it actually going to work? And utopia, you know, and utopian thinking is not just like daydreaming, but it's really practical work. I think we need to convincingly show how a non-capitalist society would actually function. Because, like, why would anyone trust us, right? Why would anyone say, let's get rid of this civilization that we know and try something completely different, even though we have no idea how it would work? Like, you have to be a fool to do that. So we need to really think through these problems, basically. You know, what is socialist democracy? You know, what is, how do you plan without markets and all that? So most, again, I organize a planning conference at my university a few months ago, and most socialists are some kind of market socialists. They want to include markets. They want to replicate the information gathering that markets do within socialism. I'm cautious about this because I think the dangers with market socialism is that you would to do that, you would keep on reintroducing certain market mechanisms such as unemployment or bankruptcy and so forth, and then you end up back at capitalism, right? When the problem with capitalism, again, is like this, it's decentralized. No one is in control of where investment actually happens. And it will go under its own momentum rather than us deciding what we want to actually do. So therefore, we can't have markets, or at least markets have to be extremely limited, right? The way we see it is that we would rely on linear programming. So this is a form of optimization mathematics. And this, again, I was saying in the book that Drew made his own very simple program. He probably have a more complicated program in an actual socialist democracy where people would play around with total plans of various kinds, right? Like, you know, what is our energy quota? How much land are we saving for nature preserves? What is our carbon budget? You know, how much warming are we happy with and all that? And then you would see if your total plan works out, right? If it actually is possible. And then we would have a debate, and then, you know, we would vote on this, and or there'd be various kinds of democratic mechanisms. Maybe there'll be a lottery for people would be elected, or maybe you have like town halls or whatever. The world is a big place. I'm sure there'd be many different ways of doing it. But let's imagine that there are rough goals, right? Like broad goals set at a global level. Because again, we need some centralization. We need some global coordination. Lots of socialists are still uncomfortable with this. But I think we have to return to internationalism, right? Because problems like zoonotic disease or problems like climate change can only be solved internationally, right? So we set this at a global level, and then different regions and localities would have more detail on actually how to solve that problem. Right. So if we have like a 2000 watt quota, and then we have to be like 50% renewable over the next 10 years, then the region will then make up a plan to actually fulfill that, because the center can't plan everything. Informational problems are serious. Like, neoliberals are right about that, you know? And then let's say I'm in Tuscany right now. What's the best way to produce energy in Tuscany? Well, maybe it's solar power or something like that. You know, where should we put the solar panels and so forth? That can be decided locally, but we still have to fit these broader contours of the plan that's set globally. And then you rely on different cybernetic mechanisms. This is where Drew's background as a climate modeler is quite nice, where you would find out ways to assimilate a lot of data and also update that data continuously, because obviously the plan isn't going to go smoothly over like a 5-year period. There's going to be hiccups, there's going to be bottlenecks, there's going to be emergencies that we have to deal with. But with these, this mix of like a static linear program complemented with various kinds of cybernetic approaches, you could hopefully plan an economy without markets. You still are dealing with many other problems, right? So if you don't have markets, how do we make sure we're getting the right information from people? Or how do we actually get people to be, you know, motivated to work and not deal with like absenteeism and all that? And this is where I think socialism has to, at some level, be a fairly modest system. This is where the energy quotas are good, actually, because you can't have people doing work they don't enjoy, right? So those people won't give you the right information. They won't want to do the work, right? If there's no unemployment or anything like that. And that means a more artisanal approach to the kind of work that we're doing. There will be some things, I'm sure, that will require some kind of factory labor. And there's ways of dealing with this. Either you give people higher compensation for unpleasant work, or maybe everyone has to do like 2 years of unpleasant work in some kind of labor battalion of some sort. But these are the kinds of problems we have to think through. But I don't think it's impossible to actually do it. So Drew and I are getting deeper and deeper into planning theory, and we're hopefully going to write another book that will kind of sketch this out more. But that's the basic contours of the proposal.
Yeah. Maybe you can elaborate a bit about what actually comes historically close to your ideas of eco-socialist planning that might give the audience a bit of an idea how this could look like. You talk about the Cybersyn experiment in Chile in the Allende time. So maybe you can talk a bit about that.
Well, there's a few things that come close, I would say. So definitely Cybersyn was an interesting proposal because, first of all, this is a government that comes to power legally through democratic elections, and they're not trying to do this like revolutionary break and all that. But they're also quite serious about socialism, where they're nationalizing huge amounts of the economy and they want to move away from markets. And they hire Stafford Beer, who's a British cybernetician and management consultant, actually. And he becomes more of a socialist afterwards. And then he's in charge of managing the system. And this is where you have, I believe it's like a 5-tier for the viable system model that he proposes, where the different parts of the system will react to each other through basic cybernetic mechanisms such as feedback, but there still will be coordination overall. So from the central planning unit all the way down to the factory floor, you want information to go back and forth. And this actually was fairly effective for dealing with certain problems, even though they were using like telex machines, which are kind of like proto fax machine, to actually coordinate the whole Chilean economy. So there actually was a strike organized by the CIA, where most, like the overwhelming majority of truckers went on strike, and they're trying to strangle the economy. And they only had several dozen loyal truckers to move things around, and they were actually able to do that through this Cybersyn program. Mm. Things have changed a lot since the early 70s in terms of cybernetic advances. Again, so there is this close relationship between socialist planning theory and Earth system science. So a lot of these techniques were developed by Soviet theorists in the 1960s and 70s. They were not allowed to implement their ideas because the bureaucracy in the Soviet Union and the party liked its powers over distribution, and they didn't want to give that up, which is why socialism really has to be democratic in order to function properly. So they went instead to ESA, which is in, or IASA, I forget how you pronounce it, the IIASA in Luxembourg in Austria, which is International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis. And they built a lot of the early Earth system models using the mathematics they developed to plan the economy. And what we're basically proposing is a return of Earth systems approaches back to economics, right? So we need to have that back and forth. And in terms of other real-life examples, there was a planning theorist in the Soviet Union in the 1980s named Olga Bermatova, and she did a lot of interesting work on the railway line that the Soviets built in the 80s across Siberia, where she was trying to include a lot of ecological parameters within the overarching plan. Right, and she didn't have great data to actually do this, but this was a valiant attempt. And then the other thing I would say is a very unpopular thing to say would be Cuba in the 1990s as another way to think about what eco-socialism might look like. And again, of course, society went through a real shock. I mean, the people went hungry. It was quite terrible. It was like as bad as the Great Depression in Cuba in the 1990s. The economy contracted by 30% or something like that. But they basically went from having lots of petroleum, where they actually use more petroleum for the agriculture in terms of like fertilizer and pesticides, to having pretty much no petroleum at all. When the Soviet Union collapsed, it stopped shipping petroleum to Cuba, and they couldn't afford to buy it on the world market. So they had to rewild a huge amount of the island simply because they couldn't have these very large industrial fields anymore. People gave up eating meat, or they ate very little meat, again, because they couldn't afford to farm at that scale. People were riding their bikes, and they were able to actually maintain educational and health, you know, programs, even though there was this crisis. So this is a little bit of maybe what an eco-social society might look like. I asked them, what does society look like if you don't have fossil fuels? So these are a few of the influences on how we think about these things.
So any discussion about planning an alternative economy has to take into account the failures of historical and existing socialisms, above all the dangers of authoritarianism, you hinged upon that, economic inefficiency as well, and the destruction of nature as well, which all these past socialisms did. So what do we have to do better as socialists today?
I'll say one more thing about socialist influences and what we think about socialism is China, right? Because China is this weird society where it's like half capitalist, but also still a party state in many ways. And, you know, the Chinese, they do implement quite large-scale environmental plans as well. For example, like 40%, I think, of the country has some kind of rewilding initiative underway, which is massive, because they're really afraid of desertification. So, I mean, there's too many herders, especially in the Northwest. In the 1980s and 90s, there was a big boom for cashmere. The goat population got too high. They destroyed the grassland, and now it's just being, you know, you have sand that's going to inundate Beijing. And they have to engage in a lot of like really quite concentrated and large scale environmental programs in terms of like dealing with, you know, what do you do with pastoralists? Who are you trying to get them off the land? Mm. And then how do you rewild? How do you have like large scale renewable transitions? How do you, you know, electrify your car fleet and all that? And China actually does this in some ways fairly well through planning mechanisms. So, but of course, China has many other problems. China is like this weird society that has like the best and worst environmental policy. So I think we have to learn, but also be very critical.
And it's deeply undemocratic, we have to say.
Yeah, China. Of course. I want to be clear. I'm not a tanky, you know, like there's many problems. And I think we have to be honest about that, right? Like I was like, what, you know, why is it so difficult to have like a really functioning democracy in a socialist society, right? Like why is it so hard? And what would it actually look like if it were to work? And then for existing, or sorry, you know, past socialist societies like the Soviet Union or the Eastern Bloc, there's a lot to learn as well. Again, like you had very smart people studying the problem of planning and trying to reform planning for decades. And I think it's a waste to just try to start from scratch in terms of like trying to imagine what socialism is. So in the book, we do engage a lot with this legacy, which has at some level been forgotten, right? I think there are very few people really working on planning theory seriously today. That's one thing. But again, I think it's also a mistake for a lot of socialists to just say, well, that wasn't socialism, right? Like the Soviet Union or Eastern Bloc, that wasn't socialism. We can learn nothing from it. Again, I think we need to be critical, but we can learn from it as well. And definitely these societies have a bad reputation for environmental problems. I mean, there's a term in German, right? Like Ostluft, right? Like you have bad air in East Germany, and Chernobyl was a problem. There's many problems, but I think it's also a mistake amongst a lot of historians to just say, well, they're both productivist, right? They're both, both the Soviet Union and the US, they both want to make lots of stuff, and they're very similar societies. And instead, you have to look at the economic logics of both societies. Like capitalism produces certain kinds of environmental problems that socialism doesn't produce. Socialism produces certain kinds of problems, but not others. Like, for example, in the Soviet Union, you had cogeneration pretty much everywhere, which means that you would use the heat from industrial processes to warm your water to heat homes, which is extremely energy efficient. And you really didn't have that in the United States. You had a lot of public transportation because people didn't know cars were relatively rare. You also relied on rail instead of trucks for transportation. So in some ways, the Soviets system, you know, did quite well environmentally, but also did quite badly in other things. But what the book is trying to do, and what I think socialists should do in general, is to learn from the past, but also be very critical at the same time.
And I think it's interesting that the discussion on planning is gaining traction right now. And I think it's also because of the wake of the corona pandemic, and we see the states like intervening. We see more industrial planning state-wise in Europe, for example. And of course, we have all sorts of planning regimes within capitalism, within, for example, big companies like Amazon or Apple or Google, etc. I'm really looking forward to how this plays out, and I would like to see you discussing this on a panel with, for example, a market socialist or a proponent of economic democracy or somebody who is more from the camp of commons-based peer production, which you criticized in the beginning as being neoliberal. But I think there are certain strands of leftist common-based peer production, which could also fit into a socialist future. And this brings me kind of to the point that at times when I read your book, which is so interesting, and again, recommendation for everybody that listens to us, but at times when it comes to planning, I found it a bit picky. And I think we have to be a bit more agnostic, especially in the situation that we're right in now. We need to be more agnostic on which kinds of economic planning and ownership models, for example, a perspective of transition can integrate and should integrate. And what comes from that, that is also up to the future to a certain degree. But when it comes to the here and now and the different strands of socialist planning and socialist ownership theory, we have to be a bit more agnostic and see a bit more common ground. But maybe I'm misportraying you and Drew in the book.
I mean, this is not like the final word on what future is going to look like. No, we're just two dudes writing a book for fun at some level and trying to think through these problems for ourselves, right? Because we started writing the book and be like, you know, what is the cause of the environmental crisis and what does it really look like to overcome it, right? And this is what we came up with for our proposal. But I think we, in general, I welcome a debate. And then I think we make this clear in the book, like you can disagree with us. You know, maybe you don't want energy quotas, maybe you don't want veganism or whatever, but put your own future forward, right? Put your own utopia forward, and that's debate utopias. And then in terms of planning, I think, you know, it's been a process for us to delve into this literature that's often, you know, decades old. But we want to spark or at least encourage other people to think seriously about planning. We don't want socialists to keep saying, yeah, you know, we have this Bilderverbot, you know, we don't want to think about the future. Instead, we should be thinking quite technically and quite concretely about socialist political mechanisms and socialist governance. So like I'm happy to you know, debate different planning theories, of course.
Yeah, and the cool thing to our audience out there is that you as well can participate in this debate and in a very playful way, sort of, because Troy and Drew also put out a video game. How cool is that? Socialists are not boring. They put out video games. So they put out a half-earth socialist video game out there where you take up the role of a planner after a socialist revolution and you plan the future with all the hurdles and all the difficulties. What is going to be produced? How much space do we reserve for nature? But you also have to keep the populace happy, yeah? Because an anarcho-primitivist way is not the way that anybody of us wants, and you won't find majorities for that. So maybe, Troy, you can briefly, because time is almost up, you can talk about why you put out this half-earth socialism game, which I also played a little bit, but I'm looking forward to playing it more. And how has it been received so far?
So Drew and I were looking for designers to make a book, I mean, make a site for the book. And then we wanted to include that linear program that I was telling you about, you know? And then these designers in Berlin at the Trust Network, they said, we're not going to make you a website. We'll make you a video game. And I was like, that's hard to turn down, right? And so we worked with a bunch of designers, including the main game designer, Francis Tseng, who's in New York at the Jane Family Institute. And we worked together with a bunch of, you know, there's a musician, there's a researcher, we had like a reading group. Many people were involved, and we put together this game. And it's trying to do what Neurath did back in the 1920s. So Neurath is like, I'm going to have a museum to show people the economy. We don't have a museum, right? So the game is like a mini version of that, where we want people to visualize what the future could look like and also see all these interconnections between the global environment, the global economy, and see trade-offs all the time. I guess you can't have everything, right? So what are you going to pick? And then hopefully it'll encourage debates of what kind of future do you want? Do you want to have nuclear? Do you want to have geoengineering? Do you want to have veganism? Let's talk about it, right? And the game, I think it's been pretty well reviewed for an indie game. It's on Steam, which is the big gaming hub. There's lots of engagement there. I think around 80,000 people have played the game, which, you know, is many more people than have read the book. So, yeah. It's, and some people have taught it in their classes. I've done class visits to help people play the game as well. And it's hopefully put the link for the game for this interview, because it's at play.half.earth, and it's free. And if you're interested in, or want to talk about it, you know, email me, and I'm happy to chat. Yeah,
totally. For sure, I'm going to put that link in the show notes, because you don't actually need Steam on your computer. You can play it on your smartphone in the browser by just typing in that website. Troy, just two more questions. One is regarding strategy, and one is just question what we could gain from socialism, because it seems to be that in eco-socialism, we will have to sacrifice some of the stuff that we might grown accustomed to. So regarding strategy, having a clear understanding of capitalism, having a clear understanding of the problem of environmental crisis and how that is linked to capitalism, that's one thing. Another thing is, of course, formulating like a broad narrative of eco-socialism that different people can fit into. And of course, discussing concrete politics and how to plan the economy as you do in your book. That's also important. But besides all of that, there is also the necessity to think about coalitions, think about the people that could lead to that transition, because your video game starts with the sentence, there was a socialist revolution, and now you are going to plan. But the biggest difficulty right now for us is to actually get to that point, to that socialist revolution, or even only a Green New Deal, for example. You know. So who in your eyes is the revolutionary subject, so to speak, and what do you think will be necessary for us to achieve such an eco-socialism?
I told you at the beginning that I study neoliberals, right, as a historian. And neoliberals, they're extremely well-organized. They have around 500 think tanks around the world with like 20,000 people working in them, plus many journalists, many economists, many political theorists and all that at different university departments. Mm-hmm. They can always make more think tanks. They even have like a foundation called the Atlas Foundation that is in charge of like franchising think tanks. They have like an annual meeting, the Mont Pelerin Society, where the 500 most important members get together and talk about strategy and all that. You know, they have lots of funding. They have AstroTurf groups, you know, and they're able to think about the long-term goal, because at some level they are utopians of a sort. They're like anti-humanist utopians who believe in their godlike market and want to set everything on the market's terms, right? So that's their endpoint. And then they can, because of that endpoint, they are cohered as a group, as they all believe in this. And then they can think about medium and short range strategy, and they can imagine like who can they work with to achieve those goals, right? Now, environmentalists and the left don't have anything like that. We don't have like an endpoint. It's too vague, I think, to be useful, as in like an environmentally stable society or like an equal society. I think that's too vague. We need to think more seriously about what, you know, what does it mean to be an environmentalist or a socialist now? And we need to have organization, and we need to have medium and short range and long range goals, right? So we need to build that up from scratch. And the neoliberals, they did that pretty soon after their initial defeats in the 1930s. So the Great Depression showed that nothing works, that laissez-faire doesn't work. So they reformulated their ideas and they started to organize. Socialism and also the environmentalist movement were really badly defeated in the 1980s, and they never really recovered. I think they never really did the work of laying out how are we different from those previous approaches to socialism and environmentalism. Mm. Instead, they were at some level co-opted by neoliberals, or they just leave things very vague. So what the book is trying to do is trying to say, okay, let's at least have these like foundational debates. Like, what is our philosophy, right? Now, what do we think? What is the future we want, right? And then we can start to think about who our allies are to actually achieve, you know, such a goal. So it's a very modest contribution in that respect. I don't think that I'm going to become like the head of some like giant movement. I don't think so. Instead, this is a part of, you know, I'm not a megalomaniac, right? I mean, so this is like a part of a broader debate to be more specific about our goals and to encourage that. Instead, we don't have time to be vague anymore about who we are or what we want, right? I mean, that was, the time was over for that 30 years ago, but we're still doing it and it drives me insane, you know? So the book is trying to push that. And then, you know, our approach or our solution, again, I hope there's many proposals, is that you can imagine environmentalists should become socialists, right? Socialists should care about animal rights. They should care about the environment, right? We all need to include a feminist critique as well. I mean, you were saying before that how like toxic masculinity is one reason why people eat so much meat, for instance. We also have to care about the post-colonial critique and use that to inform our environmental policy and our conservation policy, right? So we need to build on all this, but also we have to be critical of like, every group that I just mentioned as well, right? Like animal rights people have to, at some level, give up their utilitarianism, right? Give up their fad with crypto and things like that and become socialists. Like you can't achieve animal liberation under capitalism, you know? And all these groups have to change their belief to some degree and begin to agree on something that unifies them. And that's what the book is trying to do, is to criticize each group and hopefully offer a unifying through line for everyone as well. And I think such a coalition could, you know, they would probably number around like maybe 20% of the population or something like that. From there, you can really start thinking seriously about policy, about organizing and all that. And I'm actually very optimistic for the Spanish left. The Spanish left, they, the eco-socialist left, they're closely connected between activists, right? Like the Fridays for the Future, you know, people are part of this. They're closely connected between intellectuals, right? So people are translating. There's a group that I really like called Contra el Diluvio, and they translate a lot of eco-socialist work into Spanish, and they think very seriously about this stuff, and they're quite clever. And then there's politicians, right, who are also associated, and even in government, who are, you know, connected to these intellectuals and to these activists. And I think once you have like this triad, right, then you can begin to see some movement. And this is why we've seen debates in Spain about like, well, we have to eat less meat and all that, right? And they're getting more organized. They're having another big meeting in March to do more work and all that. So, I mean, I think it's possible to actually change the world. I mean, neoliberals have shown us that, but we need to build up our ideas and need to build up our connections between, I think, politicians, intellectuals, and activists. But I think we're very far behind, right? And we need to you know, change that very quickly. And hopefully the book and the game spur a bit of a discussion in that regard. I went on tour with the book over the last, you know, several months, and it's been quite rewarding to talk to activists and to intellectuals and politicians who have found the book useful. So there's maybe some hope, but we're losing very badly, I would say.
Yeah. One last question, Troy. Living within planetary boundaries, that would certainly entail material sacrifices, at least for us living in the global north. And since luxury communism is a hoax, I think so as well, there need to be sacrifices in the future, but there could also be gains. So gains in life quality, for example. So what would you tell people that are uncertain whether an eco-socialist future with all the material sacrifices that come with it is something that's desirable? So what would you tell them in order to make them part of an eco-socialist front or eco-socialist future?
I would say just one thing on fully automated luxury communism. And generally, I'm a skeptic, but I would say Aaron Bastani, who wrote the book, you know, of that name, he's been very kind and open-minded about these debates. And I'll say that, you know, to his credit. And also interested in like entertaining ideas of rewilding and veganism and all that. So, but some people are not, but you know, he is at least. To talk to people about the future and what it's going to hold, and to give this kind of mildly unpleasant, you know, set of parameters or set of goals, hopefully they'll see that these proposals are at least more realistic, right? They're more practical. They're more concrete than just saying, well, we'll live in a utopia and everyone can do whatever they want and we'll all live like millionaires, right? I mean, I think that was never never convincing to people outside of like the small sect of that kind of socialism. And then I think you have to tell people, you know, what are you willing to trade off, right? And have these Neuratian debates. And I think if you
present that future was like, okay, you can have all your meat consumption, you can have your high energy consumption, but you're going to piss off, you know, billions of people in the global south, and you're going to need geoengineering and have zoonotic disease, then I think that people are going to change their minds. Because I think having a stable biosphere is actually quite appealing, is worth paying a price for. And I think you also have to tell people that these problems cannot be solved under capitalism, right? It's not going to happen. And capitalism is going to ruin the world, and we're going to live under this, you know, these like white geoengineered skies with like a bunch of trillionaires controlling everything. And just remember that capitalism has never offered us so little. It's not like the 1950s and 60s where like everyone seems to be doing better and generations are actually improving in terms of their living standards. Like things are getting much worse. Capitalism is in crisis. Fascism is going to take over. Right? That's the future. So I think we can make a better alternative than that, at the very least. But we have to be practical because we have to convince others, but also be ready to, you know, take power eventually. Otherwise, we're just playing around. This is all just theater if we're not actually serious about replacing capitalism with something else and actually addressing the climate crisis.
Troy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the invitation. Yeah, it was great.